My name is Katie Leeson, and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK, and I cannot tell you how excited I am for you to hear this episode of I Shouldn't Say This, But. This week, I am joined by the VP of Marketing for Island Records, the fantastic Guillermo Ramos, who has such an incredible story to tell. Guillermo has always had an unrivaled passion for music, and ever since he was a child, dreamt of working in the industry. He tells me about the snowball effect that got him to his position with one of the world's biggest labels, the importance of making your own luck, and why he feels so privileged to call this his day job. He reveals what it's like to work with music royalty such as Ariana Grande, Mumford & Sons, Dermot Kennedy and Hozier, the artist development process, and what goes into making and marketing number one singles and best-selling albums. He shares how COVID created creativity at Island Records, forcing them to be even bolder when it came to trying new, innovative things, and gives some invaluable advice for aspiring musicians trying to cut through the attention economy as a new artist. Guillermo ends by telling me about his struggles at the start of lockdown, with his desire to be a good leader and support his team, causing him to neglect his own mental health, and leaves us with one of the best admission submissions I've heard in a long time. This is an episode that I couldn't wait to record, and it fulfilled every desire that I had. Like, getting behind the curtain of the music industry is so special, and this episode really, really lets you in on stuff that you've probably wanted to know for a long time. Honestly, this episode has so much value in it. I don't even have time to introduce everything that we cover. Instead, you'll have to listen to find out. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of I Shouldn't Say This, But. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very, very much looking forward to our conversation. I think we're going to get so much out of this, and it's an industry that I am fascinated with.
It's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast. And I'm looking forward to chatting about my role and what I do.
Brilliant. We'll jump straight in with some icebreakers and just get chatting. So what is the most underrated song that everyone should listen to?
So this is a big question. I think for me, one of my favorite albums of the last 10 years that I've not been involved with myself is the debut album by Alt-J, which came out in 2012. And there's a song on that that closes the album called Taro, which I could listen to, you know, on repeat thousands of times. So I think for me, that's one of the songs, even though they got a bit of profile and they're recognized, that song is still one of those hidden gems.
Amazing. I'm going to put that on my Spotify after this. What's the worst Christmas present that you've ever received? Because we're getting close now. We're scrambling to the end of 2020. So I'd love to know what's the worst Christmas present, and then anyone that's going to buy you anything knows to steer away from that when they listen to this episode.
Probably 100% acrylic socks. I think that was that wasn't the one. And this is back when I was much younger, but I'd wanted a Walkman for years and my parents didn't get me one. But then I got a Walkman the same day my brother, who's 3 years younger than me, got a Walkman. So that's kind of still laden with some kind of mixed feelings, shall we say. Although I ended up using the Walkman a lot. So in fact, it was a great present.
Bit of family rivalry at Christmas. You can't avoid it, can you? What is the one thing that you look forward to doing when you wake up in the morning?
I love a slow start to my day. So I like starting the day feeling decompressed. So, you know, I'll wake up, always a cup of tea first thing in the morning. Sometimes I listen to news, sometimes I listen to music, and then during the NBA season, I'll catch up on basketball games. So I'll stay off social media so as not to ruin any of the results and kind of tuck into that.
Who do you support?
It's kind of an obvious answer, but I like the Golden State Warriors. I absolutely love Steph Curry.
I'm not very good at knowledge on basketball, but I'm sure there'll be listeners that do know. If you could time travel to your past and give yourself some advice, what age would you choose to go to?
So this is a great question. I think looking back on my life, I don't feel like there's ever been a significant crossroads where I've made the wrong decision for myself. I've had some great mentors and friends that have kind of counseled me along the way and pointed me in the right direction. But I think I would probably go back to my 22-year-old self, having just finished university and really being ready to tackle getting into the music industry, and just give myself some encouragement that it's going to be possible, even if it's probably far from straightforward.
That leads us really nicely on to your career, because the music industry is like this shiny ball within any sort of world. How did you get to where you are now?
So ever since I can remember, I've always loved music so much, and I've wanted to be as close to it as possible. I've wanted to be in the mix, at the heart of where things happen, the engine room, so to speak. For a bit of context, I'm Spanish, but we moved to Germany when I was 3 because of my dad's job. So I grew up in small town Germany. And it wasn't necessarily super easy to access music through the 90s when I was a kid. I devour MTV. I wrote my first school report at the age of 9 on the history of rock and roll. There was a local record shop, and I would go there on a Saturday and just trawl through the CD shelves and just familiarize myself with artists, with bands, with album covers. And I signed up to the local library to check out CDs for a week and listen to them. So I was so hungry for it. Neither one of my parents or any of their extended network actually had any idea how to get into the music industry. So like you said, it was a shiny ball that was so appealing, but it was also behind this like really thick curtain, and you just didn't know which way to which way to pierce it. The small town where I grew up was just outside of Frankfurt, which is known for being a financial capital. So even though artists would play there, it wasn't really a vibrant music scene, as I remember. During school, I kept my head down. I tried to get as good a marks as I could, thinking that will lead me to a good university. I'll do my kind of traditional education, and then I'll be able to kind of take the leap into the unknown. I always wanted to work in London because I always think this country has produced such incredible musicians, but I also know it's the kind of the heartbeat of the European music scene. So I knew that that's where I wanted to end up. But in order to get there, I just thought I need to have enough fallback options that A, my parents will be cool with the decision, but B, that I can feel comfortable that whatever happens, I'll be fine. So I did that. I went to university. I did quite a traditional degree. And then afterwards, I moved to London. And I had one friend. And initially, he allowed to let me stay with him in his living room for a couple weeks, which became a month, which became 3, which became 7. And in that time, I was trying to get to know people in the space that would have some advice that would, I was trying to build a network. In order to get some money, I was working at a bar, and I tried to go to a venue as well that had live music. So I ended up working at Monkey Chews, which is a cult pub that was up in Chalk Farm. It's unfortunately not around anymore. I focus on that because I actually saw some of the really grassroots music promotion up close. There were live music, different people that promoted on different nights. I struggled to break the cycle of not having any direct experience, right? There was a catch-22, and I don't think it's the same now, but back when I moved to London, there was a catch-22 where you could not get into music, or you couldn't get any work experience in music without having had work experience in music. So anyway, one day I'm locking up at Monkey Chews, and there's a guy, I'm doing the till, there's a guy speaking to the owner, and both of us got kicked out at about 1:30. And as we're walking down to the bus stop, I was like, are you in a band? He's like, yeah. He's like, are you in Little Barry? He's like, hi, I'm Barry. I was like, oh my God, I saw you last year when I was at uni. So you playing? So I told him that I was trying to get into music. He put me in touch with his label. And that's then that was the first step. But from that, I managed to then kind of snowball. And over 6 months, I did maybe 7 or 8 placements with different companies. I think it was really a case of you make your own luck. If you know, you have to put yourself in a position to succeed. That is something that you can control. That, and never underestimate the power of a good cup of tea when you're doing work experience, because that gets you little conversations. If you remember just how someone likes their tea, little nugget there for anyone in a similar position. But my first job was in radio promotions. Now, I didn't actually have that much of an understanding of the industry as a whole and all the different roles within it. And so my first job, I must admit, for the first 2 months, I didn't actually know how I was going to fill my days, because sure, I get the premise of we're representing artists and we're trying to get them played on the radio or booked on TV shows. But how do you fill a day from that? Well, I found out. And it was a really incredible learning experience. I was an assistant in a really tight-knit small company. And then I got headhunted to a different company called Anorak. And the first act that I took on when I was a plugger in my own right was Mumford & Sons, this scruffy group of kids that, you know, were starting out. They just had incredible songs and they had only just started playing live. And so, you know, that allowed me to kind of grow as I grew with them and eventually signed to Island Records. We worked an incredible first album campaign and I built a lot of bridges with the people that would then go on to be my colleagues. Now, I had always wanted to work in marketing at a record label when I thought that there were 3 different options that I could pick within the music industry. Now I know there's a myriad of roles, but still I wanted to be in the mix. And I felt that marketing at a record label would be both what I'm most suited to, but also what would give me the best understanding of the workings of the business. And so I started in 2011 as a junior marketing manager, and I am 1 month shy of hitting 10 years. It's been quite a journey.
It's an incredible journey. How did you know when you were little this was the direction? Everyone says, oh, when you were little, you wanted to do this. I had no clue. I had absolutely no idea.
I just knew how excited I was by music. You know, there were songs that even as a 11, 12-year-old, you know, they could move me to tears. And I just felt like it was something that was so significant to me and something that I wanted to understand and had such a passion for, that it was always going to be my first choice. Now, you have to also appreciate, you know, I was in a small town where nobody, like even 5 degrees of separation, was in the media or had any advice. So to me, it was this kind of unattainable dream. It's like some kids dream of being pro footballers, knowing in their heart they probably aren't going to, but they still dream it. But so it started off as that for me. It started off as, wouldn't it be great to meet my musical idols at the time? And wouldn't it be even better to be able to work on their next album? And so it just kind of grew from there and it never dissipated. So it was always that ideal end point for me.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And I think the tips about putting yourself in the right positions to meet the people that you need to meet and making your own luck is something that everyone should listen to. Also the good cup of tea, because it always goes down well, doesn't it? If you know how to make someone's perfect brew.
it really does.
So why did you choose to work at Island Records? What was it that drove you to Island? Because you've been there for coming up to 10 years. What was the difference between that and other record labels?
Island has always been a really important label at the vanguard of music. So even when I was getting into music, it was one of the labels that I was already aware of and that already was extremely attractive, both for their historic roster, their active roster, and then the kind of the word on the street. Island Records was an independent record label for many years and only became a part of what eventually became Universal Music, now the biggest label in the country and in the world. It still is and independent amongst the majors. My first 5 years in the business were from the independent music scene. I worked with a lot of small labels, a lot of self-releasing artists, and there's a different kind of energy that you get from that. And there's a real like artist first mentality that comes from that. And I think that's like, I was very sympathetic to that. And I knew that Highland was very sympathetic to that. There's that. And then obviously this is primarily a people business. And so I knew a lot of the people there already, and I knew they were like-minded people. I knew that we had musical overlap, we had a really good working relationship, and we had a trust. And so it just felt like a very natural transition.
And what does your role entail now?
I am vice president of marketing at Island. And so I oversee the marketing team, and I want to lead and inspire and stabilize when there's some madness on a day-to-day level. I've got a rich experience across my own career that I can use to prod and pose questions and improve their own approach to campaigns. Ultimately, my responsibility is to help deliver the single best campaigns for our artists, while still, as a part of the senior leadership team at Island, set out a strategy for the next 5 years on how the company can continue to grow, can continue to thrive, and can continue to be on the forefront of what makes Island so special.
What's your favorite part of your job?
I think there's two favorite parts, and it might be a little bit of a cliche, but I think the music is the first. I can't believe how lucky I am, and I can't believe that I get to work with artists that I'm so passionate about, that have such resonance in this country, but across the globe. I think it's an incredibly massive privilege to be able to work with them on setting them up for a career in music. You know, we often talk about not just the here and now, maybe a first album, but we're talking about the stepping stones involved in getting to a second and a third and a fourth album. And the storyline that might come, for me, the music is really important. But actually the other and very connected part is the people. A record label is full of people that absolutely love music, which is kind of how I describe myself. And so we've already got so much common ground. Everyone is super passionate. It's a competitive industry. It's not especially big. So everyone that's in their roles is not just passionate, but also an expert in their field and with extremely big potential to, you know, become an absolute authority over the next few years. So it's exciting because there's a professional element to the people, and then there's a very significant social element. We all get on really well. We socialize at work, but also, you know, when gigs start back up, which I can't wait for that to happen, you know, we go to gigs together. And so, you know, we live it, we breathe it, and we love the palm tree. We love Island Records. So it's a really important bond that we share with our staff and our artists.
Amazing. And I couldn't ask you your favorite part without asking you your least favorite part.
My least favorite part is trying to make sense of my calendar in a very time poor environment. I guess it comes in any field, but there's always more things that you want to do than those that you're able to do. And so that tension between making time for the big picture thinking, the strategy, the long-term plans versus the detail of the here and now, the firefighting, those intricate decisions that can really affect a digital marketing campaign or mean that it unlocks certain promotional opportunities or not. So, you know, it's not my job to be in the detail, but in order to be a good leader of my team, I do need to be across the details so that I can help them make the decisions.
It's hard. It's a balance, isn't it? Making sure you've got a finger on the pulse of what's going on so you can help them when they need it, but also helping drive forward, making sure the business is continuing to develop. It's one thing that I find a real challenge as well. So I can sympathise for sure. So you've touched a little bit about Island Records and the history. Is there any more that you can tell the audience about Island Records' history and the story behind it?
Of course. So Island Records was started in 1959 by a really impressive man called Chris Blackwell, and it started in Jamaica. And Island Records, he cites as having been inspired by the song Island in the Sun by Harry Belafonte. And he relocated to the UK in 1962. It was initially known for bringing Jamaican reggae music to the world and popularizing the genre. The first success came in 1964 with My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small. And already by the end of the 60s, it had started to become a really significant player for in the kind of prog rock scene with acts like Traffic and Jethro Tull and King Crimson. It was also, on the other hand, being quite groundbreaking in the kind of psychedelic folk space with acts like Fairport Convention. And then that unlocked a new wave of singer-songwriters like Cat Stevens, Nick Drake, and John Martin. So already by the mid-70s, we touched a lot of genres and had a lot of commercial success in that space. Again, in the 70s, it was reggae music that really kind of hit the masses, and we were the biggest label for reggae music in the world, obviously with acts like Bob Marley, but also Steel Pulse and Toots and the Maytals. And even ventured into making films with the now seminal The Harder They Come that featured Jimmy Cliff. Bob Marley is an icon, not just around the world, but especially for us. And so One Love and a lot of his lyrics are very central to kind of what defines the label. And I think that's worth highlighting because it's such a mainstay and it's so enduring. Into the late 70s, you know, when people were starting to get a little bit tired of like beards and denim in the rock space, there was actually a new breed of musicians that came more from an arty direction, such as Roxy Music and Robert Palmer, that ushered in a new era. And throughout the 80s, it was acts like U2 and Grace Jones that made really profound impact on the music scene. Like I said earlier, it was in 1989 that Chris Blackwell ended up selling, having built it into the world's biggest independent label, ended up selling it to PolyGram, which I think at the turn of the millennium became Universal Music. And Island has continued to work with artists that have had as significant an impact on culture. You know, they transcend music, they transcend the charts, they've had far more of an impact. So acts like Amy Winehouse and Mumford & Sons and Keane and PJ Harvey and Florence and the Machine and Hozier. I mean, all these acts, you know, when you look at the 61-year history, it's always been on the vanguard of music. And I think Island Records is just it's a jewel because of that.
The bands that you talked about there and the artists, you must have worked on the marketing for some huge, huge artists. Which has been your favourite to work with and on in the UK and then in the US?
I mean, you are asking me to pick my favourite child. I think there's been a few marketing campaigns that have been really impactful for me and both kind of my own personal connection to them, but also how they've travelled and how people have responded to them. I think really early in my career, I worked on Gautier's Somebody That I Used to Know, which I'm really proud of. It was the biggest song of 2012, I think. And more recently, I worked with Hozier on his first album and Take Me to Church. And I think both of those songs are songs that I will still be hearing out and about when I'm 80. So I think for me, those campaigns have been really indelible in my own biography. And I think more recently, we've had incredible success with Dermot Kennedy. And I think, you know, he's got the holy trinity of hard work, dedication, and incredible music. And he's doing it all on his own terms. So I think that, you know, which has been a big priority for me and for my team and for all of us at Island over the last, say, 3 years, that's been a really, really important campaign as well.
I love his voice. His voice is incredible. What about the US?
In terms of being a part of something greater, I've really enjoyed working with Ariana Grande over her last three albums, when she has undoubtedly taken the crown as the queen of pop. So I think for me, that's been a really incredible experience.
Obviously, with Manchester, such a huge connection now to the city. And I think we've taken her under our wing as well as an honorary Mancunian. And I think she's an incredible artist and person. And I've got a bit of a girl crush on her, for sure. She's just amazing. If you could choose one artist to join Island Records, who would it be?
Well, I think there would be something beautifully romantic about having Grace Jones come back onto Island Records. Of course, you asked me about one artist. I'd probably also say that on a personal level, I would love to work with Nick Cave. I think he's an incredible artist, pure, uncompromising, honest. He's got an incredible manner with his fan base, and he's sensational on the stage. So I think that would be another really brilliant act to bring to Ireland.
2020 has been a year, and it's been a year of change for every industry. But I'd be really interested to know how COVID has changed your brand and the work that you do.
It has been a very strange year, and I'm super proud of the way that as a company we've reacted, and how the people, you know, facing their own individual challenges have reacted. I think Island has not changed in any fundamental way, but it has affected all the individuals. And so I think we've had to fine-tune some of our systems, some of our day-to-day, but we already had an infrastructure either set up by ourselves or by our external partners in the media or at retail and streaming that allowed us largely to continue as we had intended. We are still putting out great music. We have kept our release calendar pretty much exactly as we had intended at the start of the year. I think what it has done is it has forced us into new directions when it comes to innovation and creativity. And it's made us a little bit bolder to try even more new things. So we have done, you know, back in May, we as Island Records did an incredible auction that raised a lot of money. And all of that was hosted and set up completely virtually. We've ventured out into the live stream space with some of our artists making incredible moments to bring to people's living rooms. I'm thinking of The Streets and what Mike did from a venue in London, but it had lots of sets within the actual live experience. It was a fast-paced, kind of very dynamic experience rather than just broadcasting something quite static. Some of our artists have released music without having the necessary kind of promotional avenues that would usually be available to them. And so we've done our first collaboration with a big gaming company. So Disclosure, who released their album Energy earlier this year, actually built a world within Minecraft, an experience within Minecraft. It was a multiplayer world that had little hidden spaces where you could hear music. All these spaces are venues that they themselves had played over the course of their career. The world, I don't know if you know the Disclosure face, but the Energy album cover is the face embedded into a natural environment. And so that lent itself to be the world that we created within Minecraft. So a really novel, really interesting, really relevant, you know, connecting to themes that they were very passionate about around environmental health and responsibility. And it was just brilliant. So there's been a lot going on. And now we've got Jamie Cullum that's just released a Christmas album this year. And he is attempting the largest music lesson ever held as a Guinness World Record. One of my mentors always says, every problem yields an opportunity. And I must say, when I'm in the thick of things, That is sometimes annoying to hear.
And hard to see, isn't it? When you're in the thick of things, it's hard to see that. You just get embroiled by the problem. But I think that's a wonderful thing to think.
You know, we've had a lot of attention for our own and our peers' mental health and wanting to do the best possible thing for everyone at the company. And I think as a result, it's unlocked a different kind of creativity and impetus in us. And so it's been a really interesting and fun and rewarding year.
Amazing. That's just incredible. COVID's created creativity. I love it. And we know that physical events have been on hold and you've managed to work in the virtual world. And we think they're probably going to be on hold for a while. Do you think that's been a struggle for artists releasing new music, or has the pivot being into creativity been better in some ways? Because with a virtual release, you get to touch so many more people than you would through live music. I guess it's probably on two ways, isn't it? That they love performing to people in the real world, but this just spreads their message a little bit further.
Well, let me start by saying actually that I cannot wait for live music to come back. And I hope it's going to be really soon, because it's a really important thing for everyone that's a music fan. As a fan, it's a really important avenue for any artist to bring their music to the world. I don't think one takes away from the other. I think they work so impressively side by side. So I don't think that live streams would ever be the perfect substitute for live shows. Mm-hmm. But all that being said, it depends a lot on the artist. And so I do think that it has been a struggle for some of our artists, and for a number of different reasons. I think, you know, certain artists are so dynamic live that you only truly understand the whole context around an act when you see them on stage. When you see them on stage and when they see you in the crowd and they can gauge your reaction by the whites of your eyes. And so I think there's been a fan development and audience growth element that has been affected, and that has been a bit slower than one might have expected. But I think there's also a really important different side, which isn't about the growth, but it's about the rapport with the fans. And I think there are certain artists that have lines so blurred between where the band ends and the fan community starts. So I take an act like Sports Team, an alternative rock band that we've been working with for some time. Their album came out in June. Their fans were so passionate about them and so engaged in the campaign that we ran that we ended up being in a really like neck and neck chart battle with Lady Gaga for number one that week, which we had high expectations from that. We didn't think we would be like in the running for number one, knowing that Lady Gaga's album had just come out, but we were there neck and neck. And we ended up missing out by something like 400 or 500 sales, but it was an incredible kind of, it captured the imagination of the industry in a way that, you know, the Blur Oasis rivalry had. And this was an even more unlikely one. Just after that, they were nominated for the Mercury Music Prize, which is, you know, reflecting the critical acclaim and the cultural impact of an album to the industry for that year. So they've had an amazing year, but they are first and foremost a live band, and they've not been able to play. And that, for them, they'll be so sad that they've not been able to thank their fans, to give back to their fans for this incredible year they've had, that they've played such a role in. Everyone's doing the best they can, that obviously are having to do everything remotely as well. And, you know, even so, I think we haven't had a boring year. We haven't had a year where it's felt like it's been on hiatus of any kind of excitement. And so I think that even with everything considered, we can be really proud of what we've achieved. And there'll come a time, and I tell you what, when live shows come back, people are going to hit them with such excitement. Yeah. It's probably going to be carnage in the best possible way.
It so will, won't it? I drove past the Manchester Apollo the other day, and was talking to my boyfriend and he was like, do you think people will go back to gigs or do you think people will be scared? And I said, absolutely no way. It's going to go mental. As soon as people are allowed to into a venue, that's going to be it. It's going to be, like you say, I think carnage is a good word, because it's like everyone's got this built up emotion that they need to release and this tension that they've got to release, that going to a gig and going to a festival and going to a live music event allows you to get rid of, that we've not been allowed to do this year. So I think I can't wait. I really can't wait. I'm going to go wild as soon as I can. Have you noticed a difference in the way that people are consuming, listening to music? Has it changed? Have you noticed any trends?
Well, I think things have kind of stabilized a little bit. I think when we first went into lockdown, overall people were, I think, much more aware and tracking the news. And so that came at the expense of as much listening. Once we settled into remote working, once we settled into the new way or the current way, what ended up happening is that because commutes were gone, the time of day where people were listening to music shifted. So rather than it being going into work and coming back from work, it was around lunchtime or around dinner time in a way that hadn't necessarily been the case before. But I think overall, music offers consolation, it offers escapism, it offers hope, it offers comfort. And so I think music was always going to be a really important part of the kind of the balm of the nation, if you will. I think it's been maybe a little bit more challenging for brand new artists, because I think to make it a comforting thing, people initially went back to what was most familiar to them. But I think since the summer, it's kind of been business as usual, and people are still listening out for new things and sharing things in the same way. So I know these are very sweeping statements, but that's my impression of things.
No, it's really interesting to hear. And you touched on it a little bit there about the impact that music can have on people's mental health. And I feel like this year music has helped people get through a really quite difficult change in year. As you say, we all ran into it with an obsession of looking at the news, and then we've gone through the summer and the weather was nice, and then we've gone into lockdown too. It's one of the most important things that we talk about when we're doing marketing as well, is making sure your content's authentic, because you're right, there's so many orchestrated moments that people just see right through now because you're bombarded. I think it's like 4,000 advertising messages a day. People just know now when they're trying to be sold to. So that, I think that authenticity piece is probably one of the most important things. And it's something that will build a real connection with an artist and a fan, because it could turn someone off very quickly, couldn't it? If they thought that, oh gosh, I'm just being sold to here, or this is a moment they're trying to capitalize on.
An artist always has to be able to look back on anything that they've done and feel that it was an adequate reflection of them. And if they do that, they can hold their head high, irrespective of what an audience responds to. But invariably, there's such correlation from doing something that you're proud of to the audience perceiving it that way. In marketing, I think marketing can have such a kind of clinical definition to it, but actually marketing at a record label, certainly the way it is at Island Records, is much more about a 360 care and campaign oversight and strategy, so that it is, sure, it's about the paid media, but it's about the timeline, it's about the aesthetics that go around something, the artwork, the videos, it's about content ideas that are snackable, or content ideas that are meatier, that are kind of hero moments in a campaign. It's about the sequence of the kind of story arc of the artist. You know, what do you unveil at what point? How does it gradually become bigger? How do you reach a crescendo? We are in an attention economy, and not just in music, everywhere. Mm. And so the first challenge you have is getting someone's attention. The bigger challenge you have is keeping their attention. And so what we do has got to be really well thought out, and we need to be able to have a really helpful, constructive relationship with the artist so that they understand why we are sometimes thinking 6, 12, 18 months in advance, and how that helps everyone know at what point certain levers will get pulled to reach this crescendo around either the release of an important song or an album release or whatever it is.
How important is social media for Island Records?
Social media is of paramount importance. Social media is essentially your shopfront. It's where all your marketing is conducted. It's where you build your brand, especially in 2020. Mm. And for any company in the entertainment space. So, you know, you have to run your social media with great care and attention. Like we said earlier, people are very savvy and they will really only respond to something that they deem to be authentic and therefore not a waste of time. And so it has to be of a very high caliber and it has to be honest. So I'd say it's completely central because authenticity breeds engagement and engagement breeds growth. So it's all very, very important.
Has the rise of social changed how marketing's done in the music industry as a whole?
It's impossible to ignore. Mm. And it's part of the reason we have to engage in marketing is to make sure that our artists are surfaced in environments where potential fans are going to be. And I think social media, one of our artists described it recently and said, social media is where fans go to hang out. And so you need to be there and you need to hang out with them, so to speak. It's an important part of our media mix. We work on kind of growing our artist pages and profiles in an organic way, but we understand that, you know, it's about how that is combined with paid spend around it as well, just to amplify moments and, you know, just make the most of all the opportunities. So it's impossible to ignore, I'd say, Katie.
Hmm. I want to ask you a couple of questions now about the industry itself. Do you think it's getting harder to make it in the music industry?
I think it's probably getting a little harder because all the tools that a new artist might need to record and to distribute the music is available to them. It's kind of at their fingertips. It drives a culture of entrepreneurialism. It allows a lot of self-teaching and self-learning. But at the same time, in offering those opportunities to new artists means that a lot of artists are doing it. A lot more artists are doing it. And so there's a wider pool of people that are wanting to be successful in music. I think doing things yourself is a fantastic way to cut your teeth. I think it's important that you do it. I think it's important that you face challenges and figure out your own workarounds and find your own voice. Like I said before, we're in an attention economy. So you need to figure out how you're going to cut through as an artist. And, you know, you want to make things, you know, as an artist, you want it to be as good as you can make it. And then you can just stand proud that what you've put into the world is, you know, the best art that you could make. Our role at Island is to help spot those that excite us. And like I said to you earlier, it's about then supplementing and amplifying what you're already doing, maybe adding some new elements into the mix to then take it to the next level. But I do think that all the tools that you might need are definitely far more accessible for you as a blossoming artist now than they were 10 years ago when you just had MySpace.
And what would be your recommendation to someone who is a budding artist? With all those tools and putting out the best art that you can, how do you make sure that Island Records notice you as a potential future star?
I think you need to be quite sure about what makes you unique and what you stand for. I think you want to, like I said, make your music as sound as good as you can. You want to be authentic and proactive, and you don't want to give up, because I think that says a lot and implies a lot about you as an artist, this kind of perseverance, because you know what it is? It is a really interesting dynamic industry, and there's as much instinct around things as there is science. And so you need to be ready to stick at it, because sometimes things happen quickly and sometimes they don't. And that's okay too.
Just going to go to personally how you found 2020. What's it been like for you? You said you enjoyed the work, but how have you found life, and what's been the hardest part?
As we approach the end of the year, actually, I look back and I say, it's been really good on the whole. I have much to be thankful for. But of course, that's not to say that there haven't been some kind of challenging moments throughout. I think, you know, it's been a bit of an accordion of highs and lows. You know, when it first happened, I was so intent on wanting to set the right example and to kind of lead the team and reassure the team. But of course, in doing that, it's quite easy sometimes to forget to look inwards and make sure that you're giving yourself the same kind of pep talk. And so it was absolutely fine. Then the fatigue started to set in. I found really challenging how my diary about a month or two in looked a bit like a GP surgery of just like consecutive 30-minute slots where I was just sat on the same chair and lots of people came to see me. And that just, it didn't feel productive. It didn't feel good for me. So I came to terms with, okay, what changes do I need to make and how I organize my day and my time? And then the sun came out over the summer, and I'm a Spaniard. So, I mean, like a flower that was wilting, I kind of firmed up again and looked towards the sun. And so that was good. And, you know, that coincided with me wanting to get healthy and doing my little fitness plan over 8 weeks, which I did and I fulfilled. And then the nights started getting longer. And you know, I think there's a fatigue of this year. I think it's been emotionally quite a taxing year. Mm-hmm. Not specifically for me, but collectively. And so I'm feeling it as well. I'm looking forward to the Christmas break.
I am as well. I feel like I was talking to Steve, our founder, the other day, and he was saying, I bet it feels like the last few miles of a marathon. And I was like, that is the perfect way to describe exactly how it feels right now. And I think there's a lot of people out there that can sympathize with that doctor's surgery analogy. I know I'm still quite guilty of it now, because you want to be, as a leader, accessible to everyone when they need you, because you know how hard it is trying to get your head around it. So you want to be there for them. And I think it's a really important tip that you've given there for leadership, to know that, to look inward and check in on yourself. Because you can't give yourself, your whole self and your best self to your team if you're just running on empty. So I think that's a super important point. I want to finish the podcast. Obviously, the podcast's called I Shouldn't Say This, but it's because in each episode, I open up with honesty and I talk about subjects that someone in my role as an MD would usually avoid. So I've talked about imposter syndrome, anxiety, fear of failure, to name but a few. Would you mind ending this podcast with an admission of something that you probably shouldn't say, whether it's about struggles you've faced during your career, a secret about your lockdown experience, your own personal demons, or what you'd like to change about yourself? So
I shouldn't say this, but I still feel like a student on the first day of school. I feel quite often so wide-eyed and nervous and excitable, but also sometimes with this sense that there is still so much to learn, that it's a little bit overwhelming sometimes, that, you know, are there elements where I'm out of my depth? And honestly, these are just kind of glimpses, but it's all that excitement that's embroiled in a first day in an exciting new kind of school where the big boys go. And I remember being a kid going to high school on my first day, and I kind of still feel like that a little bit. I'm like, there are so many things. The industry is moving so fast. Technology is moving so fast, exponentially. New business models are always popping up and being tested. trends are ever changing, and it's a lot to assimilate, and it's a lot to take in and reference in your day-to-day decision making. Every kind of challenge creates a new line of thinking and a new opportunity. So I think it's all the excitement, but sometimes some of the nervousness that isn't so positive that comes with it. And ultimately, I still wouldn't change it for the world. I can't believe I do what I do. And it's a pleasure.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much. It's been so good to talk to you, especially with how much passion you have about the industry you work in and the drive that you got put into it to get there. And then to hear about the way that you've pivoted in this year, and also how it's been a positive year for the industry and the development of artists. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing the music that comes out next year. Thank you so much. And hopefully I'll see you at a gig.
Yes, I'd like that very much. Thank you so much for having me on, Katie.
Thank you so much. Thanks.